operate the chem cam or the apex unit or what have you. Let me drop it.
Yeah, I got a quick question, Paul. My quick question, and I'll go over to Scott in a second. The signal is coming from Curiosity. I think the majority of the time they are uplinked to a Mars orbiter, and the Mars orbiter, as a repeater, sends them back on X-band, roughly 8.4 gigs to Goldstone. I think the majority of the signals from the Curiosity are not coming directly to the deep space network. And is the uplink from Curiosity to the Mars orbiter, is that a VHF or is that also an X-band, if you happen to know, Paul? WS2N, K2RAW.
They use the orbiters, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and Mars Odyssey, as repeaters. Mars Global Survey, that's not working anymore. That was one of the other ones they used to use. And they have a European Space Agency, Mars Express in orbit if they need to use it as a backup. But MRO, that's the big one. That's like a huge satellite. And Odyssey, that predated MRO, are the two that they're using. And it's all 70 centimeters going back and forth to the orbiters from Curiosity. A little higher than the handbands, I think it's 250 range or something. And then, 450 range on 70 centimeters. And then the X-band, yeah, that's the one that's coming back from the orbiters to Deep Space Network. But you do have this 1 foot diameter dish on Curiosity that can point and does point to Earth, and they can utilize that. But also, 99% of the time, they'll use the orbiters unless there's a problem. Then they'll go to the dish on Curiosity. But that's the story about the communications, Dick. Let me drop it. Anything else on that?
Hey, you called it a dish. I think it's a 1 foot square flat phased array that's durable. And I believe Scott wants to make a comment. VE3Z Tango Z K2RAW. That was you, Scott. Go ahead.
W2CA.
Whiskey 2 Charlie Hotel. I'll start off with your name, sir, and then your comment or question.
Yes, fine, Dick. W2CH Ray and White Plains. I didn't hear the other station, but I just want to interject one thing I saw since we're on Mars. I saw there is a consortium of people. It's out of a Dutch group, and it's called Mars One, and starting next year, they're working on trying to send people to Mars after preliminary work is done previous to it in 2023. Have you heard of that?
No, I have not, Ray, but I am starting off very skeptical. Yes, we've gone to the moon, and it cost us $30 billion to do that by way of the Apollo program in 1969 dollars. Today, that would be closer to $100 billion just to go to the moon. And going to Mars is, I'm going to pick out a number out of the air, approximately 1,000 times more difficult. So to send a man to Mars, where it's the coldest, driest, low air pressure desert in the world, you really don't want to send a man there. So to study the details of what is required, yes, that's a worthwhile project. To think they're really going to do it, I think if all of the resources of your developed nations on planet Earth pooled all of their resources, I don't think there's enough money to do it, if you know what I mean. So I'm starting off very skeptical on that, Ray. And one last point on that.
I heard of that group, by the way, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead and tell me a little bit about that one, Paul.
The Netherlands, and they're putting together a group, and they're going to be, oh, let's call it like a general contractor. And they're going to get, oh, maybe, for example, if they could talk SpaceX into doing this, or Bigelow, or, you know, all the different outfits, or private companies, or anybody that's interested. There's groups around that are working on spacesuits, and they're going to try to, you know, coordinate all these people, bring them together under their leadership, and then eventually try to make a plan for, you know, a man shot to Mars. I've seen interviews with them, and I mean, they're serious about what they're doing, but like you said, they've got a long, long way to go. I mean, first of all, they've got to talk all these companies into getting involved. Most of them are already involved with their own projects. They're going to have to find money. They got a long way to go. Back to you.
And one of the things that I've said quite often, Ray, that we all forget about, is what does it take to maintain a human being? Every month or so, a Progress spaceship goes up to the International Space Station, brings them many thousand pounds of consumables, which are giving them oxygen, water, food, and other pieces of hardware. It takes a lot to maintain a human being in space. If I add up the amount of air, water, and food that you, Ray, consume in 1 year, it has the approximate volume of your house. It has the approximate mass or weight of your house. That's what's required to maintain you for 1 year. And a Mars mission would be something like 3 years. And so that amount of material, three times over for each individual astronaut, is just out of the question as I see it. And we can easily say the word recycling, but to recycle every single molecule of gas, fluid, and solid that comes out of a human being and recycle every molecule, that's a technology way beyond what we've talked about up till now. Every breath you take, Ray, contains air molecules that were once inside the lungs of every human being that has ever walked planet Earth. I mean, you wait 100 years and Mother Nature recycles everything that comes out of you. But look how big a resource called planet Earth is required to do it, and to do that with artificial machinery, and maintain that machinery for 3 years. And if that machinery hiccups, you got a whole bunch of dead astronauts. So very expensive, very little return, very difficult, chances of survival very poor. I don't think it's going to happen. You see where I'm going on that one, Ray? Whiskey 2, Charlie Hotel, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, K2RIW in the net, W2CH. Well, very interesting. I know they're saying around $6 billion, and they want to do kind of a reality show format or something like that to follow what they're doing. They have quite a bit on the website, which is Mars1.com, and as Paul said, he's heard and seen things about them. I had never before actually was posted on Coast to Coast, which is not always the most down-to-earth, although this is based on something, but I agree, it seems like a very difficult thing. That's why it's taking so long to try and reach a point that you've only seen in science fiction. So thank you for the comments and letting me comment on that. The K2RIW, W2CH.
Very fine, Ray, and thank you for stopping in. And Paul, back to you. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I'm glad W2CH brought that up. I wanted to talk about that a couple of weeks ago when I saw that, but I completely forgotten about it. And it's good to talk about it. I mean, they have their heart in the right place, but what did he say, $6 billion? I don't know, maybe $6 trillion. I think it's something like that. I think it's $18 billion just to put the space telescope, James Webb Space Telescope, 1 million miles away from Earth. So I could imagine what it would take. You know, I mean, I buy a lot of water, a case of water all the time. You know, at least one or two a week, you know. What does that weigh? 30 pounds? You know, over a year, it's got to be a couple of thousand pounds. 3 year mission. I don't know. So just water alone, I would need like the weight of 3 cars just to bring with me. And I think it's something like $10,000 a pound. So it's going to be an expensive trip just for water, Dick. I'll drop it. I just want to talk about one other successful launch that they had this week. The NASA launched the NICE scientific mission. They want to investigate the Van Allen belts. I was talking to John about it a couple of weeks ago. KC2 WGB. And they got it off. It was delayed, I think, when we were speaking about it. And they finally get this thing off the ground. It's two spacecraft going into a relatively equatorial orbit, and it's two spacecraft launched by one rocket, an Atlas V, the other day, and it was a night flight. It's actually, the inclination is 5 degrees, but it's close enough to, you know, to be near the equator. It's going to investigate the Van Allen belts. It's going to go out a highly elliptical orbit. The lowest part being around 400 miles, and the highest part being around 24,000 miles. So they'll be able to follow one another and take readings. The radiation belt. It's supposed to be a 2 year mission. It'll be extended to at least 4 to 8 days when we drop it. They have the two is they want to take readings as they go through the belts over and over again. And if some anomaly happens, they want to make sure, well, it's happening to both spacecraft at the same time. Make sure that, you know, what the readings that they're getting are exactly what they're looking for. They really want to study these Van Allen belts, and, you know, for good reason. The space station, any of the space stations, International Space Station, the Mir Space Station that used to be up there, even the Salyut 7 space stations, everything there, even Skylab, at very low Earth orbit, nothing high. And the reason for that is they'd be going through these Van Allen belts. Apparently there's two layers of this Van Allen belt. And they're going to look into all of this, and they finally got this thing up in the air. Let me drop it. And it was originally proposed in 2007. So it looks good. They're big satellites. I mean, each one is 2,000 pounds. So there's a lot of equipment in there. You know, they look big when a man's standing next to it. And where they got these things off, I like the science satellites that get up there. That's pretty much it, Dick. Unless anybody has any questions, this is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet.
WGB with a question.
You got it, John.
I think question for Paul is, there are two of these Van Allen belt rings. Are they concentric or are they superimposed on top of each other and the space between them? Back to you, Dick.
I think there's a so-called inner Van Allen belt and an outer Van Allen belt, and there's a separation of space in between the two. Paul's going to correct me on this. And when you get a major coronal mass expulsion or ejection, whichever it's called, CME from the sun, the blast of a zillion pounds of charged particles come roaring toward the Earth at 1 or 2 million miles an hour. When it hits the Van Allen belt, the Van Allen belt does get distorted, and it can give you some aurora responses and things like that. I am guessing these satellites are going to be looking at the way the Van Allen belts get distorted on each individual CME. Is that approximately what's going on, Paul? On top of that, you said each one of these satellites is 2,000 pounds, and there's two of them, and they were launched by one launch vehicle. Does that mean 4,000 pounds of payload was launched? That's a lot, particularly for such a high elliptical orbit. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's why they had to use the Atlas V. That's the big rocket that we use now. Years ago, was, they had the Titans and all of these different Titan IVs. They still use it. They don't use the Titans anymore, but the Delta IIs, they look a lot of payload, but the big one now is the Atlas V. That's the same one that launched New Horizons to Pluto, and they wanted to get that there in a hurry. And that's the same vehicle that launched Curiosity. They needed a big one for that as well. So, yeah, highly elliptical, that's the reason they do it. In other words, and it's a 9-hour orbit, so every 9 hours they'll be coming through two different rings of the, they'll be passing the rings four times because, it's coming back toward Earth and then going back out again. And they'll see what kind of science they can get out of these things. I haven't found too much about the science instruments that are on board. Found that. In fact, it was hard. Let me drive it. It took me a long time to figure out what kind of orbits this is going to be in. They had the launch dates. They had they showed the vehicles. They showed how they're stacked together and put together in one big bearing. They show the animation of the launch with the Atlas V on the bottom and then the Centaur 1, a highly reliable second stage rocket, and they showed the separations of the first rocket. They had them stacked on top of one another for the first payload and then the second satellite, and eventually I found out it was a 5-degree inclination and roughly 24,000 actually they didn't even give the miles. They gave it in radii. I think it was 5.8 Earth radii. And low point perigee would be, I think that was, they did that in kilograms. I don't know, I figured that was around 400 miles, 350 miles at a low point. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I just looked up the Atlas V, and each individual engine, I think, has got 0.9 million pounds of thrust. And are there two engines on the very bottom of it? What do you believe is the takeoff thrust on that vehicle, Paul?
Of course, the vehicle without any boosters on it. I've forgotten. I know it's probably 1.5-2 million. But then you've got the boosters, and you can have 2, 4, or 5. Don't know how many boosters they had on this one. They had any at all. I don't remember seeing any. The most they've had is 5 boosters, solid boosters. And that was for New Horizons and I believe the Juno mission. I'm not too sure about that. I'm positive about the New Horizons. And I believe they had 4 boosters for Curiosity. Back to you, Jim.
It sounds like we're getting kind of close to what was used with the Apollo mission. I think that total takeoff thrust was around 5.5 million pounds. I guess it was called the Saturn V. Is it true, Paul?
Yeah, takeoff thrust was 7 million on the Saturn V, so we got to go up a little higher. 5 million was for the space shuttle with the big solid boosters on the shuttle. That was around 5. It was just over 5.
Wow. Yeah, I vaguely remember that astronaut Owen Garriott at one time announced how many pounds of takeoff weight and how many pounds of thrust. And I vaguely remember he said 4.5 million pounds of weight and 6 million pounds of thrust. He was rounding off the numbers. Sound about right, Paul?
Up on the S4B, he didn't go up on the Saturn V, he went up. you know, the shortened version, because he went to on the Apollo spacecraft. He went up to Skylab. They had three missions to Skylab, and they didn't use the Saturn V for that. They did use the Saturn V to put the Skylab into orbit, though. And that was the last launch of the Saturn V rocket.
And once again, did you say 7 million pounds of thrust on Saturn V?
Look that up. I'm going to go with 7.5. I think it was 7.5. It was definitely 7 million. But 7.5.
That's a whole bunch. Okay, anybody with any further questions or comments on the space section, give me your call letters right now.
WGB with a question.
You got it, John.
Paul, when this new Van Allen craft is going in its orbit, does the Apogee go past the Van Allen belts and then come back through it again? Does it go completely out? Is it making that full coverage?
Oh yeah, it goes. It does go right through it and then come back. And they used a special manufacturing technique, which they'll be using more in future launches to protect the circuitry. They would sandwich all these electronic boards together. You know, let's say you put a spacer between each one, board, and a little space between each one. You know, four different spaces, and then they would put all of these boards in one box, and then they would fill it with I don't know what something. There's some kind of a paste or a glue or something. I mean, they inject into this thing, and it becomes I don't know. To me, it looks like one gigantic chip. You know, it might be like a 10-inch board. You know, one on top of the other, but it's all now filled. I mean, you're never going to take this thing apart. I mean, it's filled solid, and whatever this is, I'm sure it's not lead, but it's some kind of protective goo that they put in there to protect it from all this radiation. You know, I mean, this thing is going through the radiation belt, what did I say, four times every 9 hours, so there's a whole bunch of these, a series of these boards that they're using, and they're going to use, see how it works out, and they'll use them on future missions, and eventually future Mars missions, to keep the radiation away from them, all the electronics, at least, John. Back to you.
Sort of like suntan lotion for radiation. That gel that they bump in there. Back to you, Dave, KC2WGB.
Now, earlier tonight, John, I heard a man named John, Ray, K2CYR, wanted to discuss circular and linear polarization. Do you think Ray is still around? Let me give you a quick call for Ray first. K2 Charlie Yankee Romeo, I think it is. Are you on board, Ray, K2RIW in the TechNet? When you talked to him earlier today, John, did he say he was going to be able to wait around and he was going to sign in and he wanted to discuss that particular subject? Sounds like something he's wanted to discuss for a number of weeks. Over to you, John.
Yes, Dick, he's been trying to get in and he hadn't succeeded. I believe he's working tonight. He's monitoring, but he's not able to talk to us. So he asked me if I would present it, and maybe you could give him a little dissertation. He's working at 440 megahertz, and he is concerned about the differences between the polarimetry. I'd like to know the difference between circular polarization, vertical and horizontal, and that's where he thinks he has an issue. So maybe you could describe all of the effects and how sometimes polarization doesn't really matter. In the vertical and horizontal spectrum. So I'll throw it over to you, Dick, and you can give him a little bit, and he'll email me again if he needs more information, or maybe next week he can stop by if he has any further questions. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
And after that, I have some more questions about the antenna.
Yeah, the IEEE defines polarization as the direction of the E field of the antenna, not the H field, the E field. So if I've got elements of a Yagi that are parallel to the ground, and the Yagi is aimed at the horizon, by IEEE definition and an agreement, that is a horizontally polarized antenna. And if I'm talking to a guy a short distance away, like a small number of miles away, and if his antenna is also horizontal, he'll get the maximum signal from me when the two are aimed at each other. And if either one of us, just one at a time, aimed the antenna vertical while the other one was horizontal, they would be cross-polarized, and in theory, the amount of reception would be drastically decreased. It wouldn't quite be zero, because as that signal comes out of your antenna and it reflects off the ground and the water towers and the buildings and everything else, there is a small amount of polarization scattering that takes place. But if this was an anechoic chamber or a non-reflecting environment, then horizontal polarization would stay horizontal polarization. And there's nothing about nothing magic about pure horizontal or pure vertical. You could also set the antenna up slant 45 degrees to the right or slant 45 degrees to the left. The Yagi antenna that I'm using right now on my 100-foot tower to transmit to this particular repeater is a 14-element Cushcraft antenna, which is slanted at a 45-degree angle in polarization, which means I'm halfway between the horizontal people and the vertical people. I can talk to the horizontal people, which are primarily single sideband, down at 144-200, and I can talk to the vertical people that are above 145 megacycles most of the time. And I'm 3 dB down from each, but because of my slant 45-degree polarization. That's linear polarization. Let me drop. Now, there is something called circular polarization, where if I could stop the wave in space from my horizontally polarized antenna, stop time, stop the wave, and look at it, it would look like a squiggly piece of wire, so to speak, that squiggles back and forth in the horizontal plane, and one squiggle per wavelength. And that whole squiggly piece of wire, when I start turning time back on, would all be moving through space at the speed of light. That's what the horizontal wave would look like. Okay. A circular polarized wave, if I could stop time and look at it, would look like a spiral. It would look like a helix. The polarization rotates at the rate of the carrier. If I had one single plane of observation and the wave is propagating through it, and as the wave propagates through that plane, it makes a dot on the plane, so to speak, I would watch that dot walk around the circle 360 degrees once every carrier. If I was doing it at 500 megacycles, 500 million cycles per second, each cycle is half, it is 2 nanoseconds in length. So the dot on my plane of observation would walk around that circle once every 2 nanoseconds. So the way you generate circular polarization is very similar to the way you make a circle on an oscilloscope. There's a kind of traces you can put on an oscilloscope screen, which are called Lissajous patterns. But if I put a sine wave into the horizontal plates of an oscilloscope and a cosine wave into the vertical plates, that's a fancy way of saying I'm putting a sine wave into both, but I'm delaying one of them by 90 degrees. If I did that on an oscilloscope...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
If I did that on an oscilloscope screen, a sine wave into the horizontal plates and a sine wave into the vertical plates, but one is 90 degrees ahead of the other in phase, I will draw a complete circle. If I put a sine wave into the horizontal and a sine wave into the vertical plates of an oscilloscope and they're in phase, I'll make a straight line across the screen at a 45 degree angle. Put an only horizontal signal, I'll get a horizontal line. Put only vertical signal, I'll get a vertical line. Combine the two, I'll get a slant 45 degree line. And as I start creating a phase shift between the horizontal and vertical plates, that slant 45-degree straight line starts opening up as an ellipse, and as I approach the point of 90 degrees of phase shift, it becomes a complete circle. It turns out antennas behave in a very similar manner. I could build a Yagi, and I've done this, where I've got one boom, I've got a bunch of horizontal elements on the boom, displaced a little bit further forward, I've got a bunch of vertical elements on the same boom. And if I feed a signal into the horizontal elements and a signal into the vertical elements, and I carefully arrange things so that the two signals are equal in amplitude, but one leads in phase by 90 degrees compared to the other, quarter wavelength, then that antenna will transmit a circular polarized wave.
How do you do that? How do you maneuver with the signal?
I could have a power divider coming out of the transmitter. The two cables coming out of the power divider, one cable is 90 degrees longer than the other. Those two cables, one goes to the horizontal elements, one goes to the vertical elements. Now I'm feeding them 90 degrees out of phase, but equal in amplitude. And those two cables going to the horizontal and vertical elements of this one common Yagi would make a circular polarized wave. And now the advantage of the circular polarized wave is now, no matter who I talk to, if I'm talking to a vertically polarized guy or a horizontally polarized guy, both of those guys will hear me with equal amplitude. They'll hear me with equal amplitude. That's the good news. The bad news is that half of my power is horizontal, half of my power is vertical. Each guy only gets half of my power. It's a 3 dB disadvantage. So there's all kinds of polarization mismatches that can take place. Horizontal versus vertical, in theory, gives you a perfect null. Horizontal versus slant 45 gives you a 3 dB error. Circular versus linear gives you a 3 dB error. So let's call it partial depolarization. Now, one of the things that people would love to do, they'd love to be able to transmit a circular polarized wave into every direction in space simultaneously.
How do you keep control over the amplitude? How to make sure it's possible?
Lots of people want to do that. You cannot do that. You can. There's a kind of an antenna called a Lindenblatt antenna, which will allow you to transmit circular polarization simultaneously to every direction on the horizon. It's a pancake pattern, and every direction on the horizon gets a circular polarized signal. But if you want to transmit a circular polarized signal out to the horizon and straight up at zenith,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Circular polarized out to the horizon and circular polarized up at zenith simultaneously, you cannot do that. By the same token, an isotropic antenna, a light bulb in the middle of a spherical room, is an example of an isotropic antenna. Every square feet of that spherical room gets the same number of watts per square meter. But there's a catch. The light bulb is an incoherent source. And yes, an incoherent source, which has scrambled or randomized polarization, can transmit what looks like an omnidirectional signal. If that light bulb now became a real dipole, the dipole, as you know, is going to have a three-dimensional antenna pattern that looks like a donut, and there's a null off the ends of the wire of the dipole. And a turnstile antenna also can give you circular polarization in one direction, a turnstile where the two sets of dipoles of the turnstile are all parallel to the Earth. It would make a perfectly circular polarized signal straight up, but the turnstile antenna would be transmitting a linear polarized signal out to the horizon in all azimuth directions at once. So lots of guys would like to have linear polarization in every direction at once in a purely isotropic manner. You can't get that. Lots of guys would like to have circular polarization across the whole hemisphere, above your piece of property, it can't do that. You can make a circular polarized antenna that's got a pencil beam to it, and you can aim it at the satellite you're interested in. And one of the advantages of circular polarization is that if you're talking to a satellite that is rotating, you don't get a wow to the amplitude of signal versus time as the satellite rotates when you're using a circular polarized antenna. But there's a couple of catches. To make really perfect circular polarization with very little elliptical characteristic to it, the peak and valley of an ellipse of elliptical polarization, the peak-to-valley ratio is called the axial ratio of that antenna. And a real good circular polarized antenna might have an axial ratio that is smaller than 1 decibel. As you start getting more and more elliptical, that axial ratio gets to bigger and bigger numbers. In the extreme, a linear polarized antenna has an axial ratio that's nearly infinite in dBs, because it's got a very sharp null when you're cross-polarized. To test a circular polarized antenna on an antenna range is a rather difficult requirement. You're making a much more severe requirement on the quality of an antenna range, because a circular polarized signal aimed out at the horizon, and some of it bounce off the ground, because there's always ground reflection in that environment. A clockwise circular polarized signal that bounces off the ground, that bounced portion of the signal becomes counterclockwise. The reason for that is the horizontal component on ground bounce experiences a 180-degree phase reversal. The vertical component does not experience a 180-degree phase reversal. Therefore, after the bounce, clockwise becomes counterclockwise. Let me drop.
Like a mirror.
It's a good way to put it, John. To a radio wave, that ground in front of your antenna is close to being a very good mirror. Not perfect, but not bad. And now, if you're running an experiment where you've got in your hand a radio frequency identification reader, and some of the handheld RFID readers do have circular polarization. The reason you use circular polarization is that the dipole that's on the RFID tag that's hanging from that shirt that's in front of you 20 feet away, depending on whether the dipole on that RFID tag is horizontal, vertical, or slant 45, in theory, by using your circular polarized antenna that's on the handheld reader in your hand, it can read the tag regardless of the tag's orientation. That's the simplistic way of looking at it. Now let's look at the real world. In the real world, you're standing on a tile floor that's got concrete underneath. That floor is highly reflective radio-wise. Off to your left-hand side is some metal shelves that have got some pants on them. Off to your right-hand side is a rack that's holding some shirts, and it's metal and it's reflective. In the real world, and you got a ceiling that's reflective, and you got beams in the ceiling. In the real radio world, you got all kinds of reflections. And as such, there are nulls in space. You know that for a fact, that when you're listening to a weak signal with your handy talkie and you walk around the room, you'll find there are certain places where the signal disappears. There are nulls in space because of reflections. It's called the multipath RF problem. So even with circular polarization, you're still going to get nulls in space. When the signal bouncing off the concrete floor you're standing on, and your signal is coming out of your handheld reader, in my example, it's clockwise, circular, polarized, and the signal bouncing off the ground becomes counterclockwise, therefore the signal that gets to the tag that's 20 feet in front of you is getting there by at least 2 major paths at once, the direct path in air and the reflective path off the ground. When you mix a clockwise wave in free space, through the air, with a counterclockwise wave that bounced off the ground, when you mix the two together, if they were equal in amplitude, clockwise plus counterclockwise generates linear craziness. And the linear that it generates, is it going to be horizontal, vertical, slant 45 right, or slant 45 left? The answer is yes. Which one? It's a function of the path length difference. If you did a careful study of the signal that got to that tag, where there was just two paths, in my simplistic example, one through air and one bouncing off the concrete you're standing on.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Those two signals mix together, and maybe at this instant of time, they mix together and cancel each other and result in a, it's not a cancellation, it's a certain vector mixing phenomenon by which, let's say, it generates a slant 45 degree linear polarization at the tag because of the two signals, the two CP signals mixing together. Now, as I take the tag reader in my hand and I simply raise it vertically, don't change the aiming, I raise it vertically a couple of feet, the path directly through air didn't change very much, maybe not at all. The path reflecting off the ground got longer because it's starting off at a higher location because I raised my hand. I've now changed the path length of the indirect path versus the direct path. When I did that, the slant 45 signal started rotating toward horizontal or vertical, the mixing of the two. So as you can see, if you're trying to read a tag, even though you've got a circular polarized transmitter in your hand and the tag is linear and you think it's going to cover all cases, it might not. If that tag happened to be slant 45 left and the mixture of the two signals ended up as slant 45 right, the tag will not respond. The tag will sit there and say, I ain't seeing nothing. Anybody got any questions on all this so far? Circular polarization. It's got some advantages and got some disadvantages. The broadcast world, from time to time, your television broadcast transmitters have experimented with circular polarization, and they expected to get a glamour fix out of it. From my point of view, they didn't get a glamour fix. I think some of the UHF channels are using CP. I think the vast majority of the VHF channels are using linear polarization, horizontally polarized. If Eric is around, he could give us some update on that. Anybody got any questions or comments? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WNZCN.
Okay, John and Wes in that order. Go ahead, John.
Dick, then, would it be fair to say that in your example of the cross-polarized crossfire Yagi creating a circular polarization, the RF envelope that's leaving, we could consider that, looking at it like a slinky being stretched out. Would that be correct? And of course, the lower the frequency, the more stretched out that slinky would be, the higher the frequency, the more compressed it would be. Would that be a fair representation for him to understand?
That's very close, John. The slinky stretched out does show you what a circular polarized wave would look like at one instant of time if you stopped the clock. Now, as you start letting the clock flow forward, that whole slinky is moving forward at the speed of light. But at one instant of time, that slinky that you just drew is what you would see if you stopped the clock. I wonder if that was explained to you that way, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Well, that's how I envisioned it from the first time you described circular polarization like a year ago, and that's how I imagine it. Of course, now when you modulate it, you're going to have undulations on the slinky wires itself, but just the raw carrier would look like the slinky. That was my conception. KC2WGB.
That's correct. Wes, go ahead with your question.
Two questions. First, how do you control the amplitude? You have vertical and you have horizontal. Second question, would you picture that slinky moving forward as a concentration of energy that is going forward? So at one point in time, there is a more concentration of energy and it's just flowing at that particular direction. And to you.
Let's start off with a simple horizontally polarized Yagi. And the way you normally plot the pattern of that antenna, it really is a slice. If I plot the so-called E-plane pattern of it, it's a slice through the three-dimensional antenna pattern. And when you display that on a piece of rectangular coordinate paper, you see the main lobe and some side lobes. If I could see the three-dimensional pattern, it would look like a very fat cucumber in space. That's the three-dimensional antenna pattern. If I could see the amplitude of the signal coming off of the simple horizontally polarized Yagi, it would look like a cucumber in space, where the peak of the cucumber is in the direction down the boom of the antenna. That's what the pattern would look like.
The cucumber is going to look like it's moving on the line, linearly.
And there's some rings around the base of the cucumber, which represent the side lobe. So the cucumber, the main lobe is a cucumber, and there's some rings around the base that are the side lobes. That's a horizontally polarized antenna. A vertically polarized antenna would be almost identical. A circular polarized antenna, if I'm only plotting amplitude versus three-dimensional angle in space, it would be the exact same cucumber with the exact same rings around the base that represent the side lobe. When you take a slice through that cucumber, that's the antenna pattern you normally see displayed in the advertisement for the antenna. You see the main lobes and the side lobes. But that's just a slice through this three-dimensional object called antenna pattern. Now, the fact that you've made it circular polarized doesn't change the pattern per se. And how do you change the amplitude of horizontal versus vertical? If I feed twice as many watts into the horizontal versus the vertical, then the watts are stronger than the vertical. It's how many volts or how many watts you put into those particular elements of the antenna. That's what gives you the balance. To make pure circular polarization.
But you have a time delay.
Yes. And the time delay is only something that you can find out exists when you make a careful measurement. Under normal circumstances, you don't know that time delay is there after I have issued it. I use the time delay as a method of generating the circular polarization, very similar to the way I use the time delay on the horizontal plates versus the vertical plates on the oscilloscope in order to draw a circle on the screen. So whether I'm drawing a circle on the screen of an oscilloscope or whether I'm generating a circular polarized signal in space from my horizontal and vertical elements of this cross-polarized Yagi, there's a strong similarity between the two.
With the time delay, I have a problem with amplitude control. I just don't understand it.
I took the signal out of the transmitter and I went into a 2-to-1 power divider. I now have two output cables. I started off with a 2-watt transmitter. I went into the power divider. I now have two signals of 1 watt each. I make one of those 1-watt cables a quarter wavelength longer than the other. That doesn't change the amplitude. It just changes the time delay. It changes the phase shift. The longer cable I send to the horizontal elements, the shorter cable I send to the vertical elements. Now, by IEEE standard, the horizontal is getting the delayed signal. That really means if I had one single plane of observation, and I'm checking on what the antenna does, the instantaneous signal comes out with polarization that's parallel to a clock, and it's parallel to the 12 o'clock position. The signal that's delayed is about to give me a signal at the 3 o'clock position, but because it's delayed, it doesn't happen at first. When I put it all together, I'll see the signal at the carrier rate. I slowed down time. I slowed down time by 1,000,000 to 1. I'll watch the signal at my plane of observation start at 12 o'clock, slowly sweep toward 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, and so on. I'll watch the signal as it pierces through my plane of observation. I'll watch the signal walk around that clock, and it has equal amplitude from the center. It's walking around the perimeter of a clock face that I've drawn on this plane of observation. So the delay allows it to sweep a circle as opposed to sweeping a 45-degree line, and that's exactly what you see on an oscilloscope screen when you're drawing lizardew patterns. Does that make some sense? K2RIW.
Yes, it does. Now, I have a question. You have a distance of 1 million miles, and you transmit your circular pattern, well, whatever, let's say circular pattern, and you give a pulse, one pulse, 1 nanosecond, whatever. Rise time, let's say 20 nanoseconds, rise 20 nanoseconds pulse width, and 20 nanoseconds is a fall time. When you observe in space how that pulse travels, would you then be able to picture a concentration of energy going on the straight line to the given point if the antenna has a controlled polar, controlled pattern of the transmission?
You don't have to pulse the signal to measure polarization characteristics.
Now that's...
There's a whole series of radio telescopes that do a measurement that's called polarimetry. They measure each particular radio source they look at, each individual star, each nebula, and whatever, each galaxy. You can measure how much is the amplitude of the horizontal, how much is the amplitude of the vertical polarization, and what is the phase angle between the two. Therefore, you know, is that star sending out a horizontal, vertical, circular polarized, slant 45? By knowing the polarization of the signal coming out of the star and knowing something about the so-called Zeeman effect, you now know something about what is the local magnetic field in the vicinity of that star. So without even having the star having to do any pulsing for you, with the right kind of instrumentation on your radio telescope, you can make a polarimetry measurement. That's a fancy way of signing for saying you now know, after you finish making that measurement, what is the exact polarization characteristics of the signal coming from that star. Back to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Okay, thank you very much for that. But would you be able to picture that if the pulse has a given time, which would be the wavelength, then you made the pulse and it's one pulse only, would you then picture it in three-dimensional pattern as the concentration of energy flowing on the straight line to the given point?
I think I see where you're going, and I'm going to show you a problem. The very fastest pulse transmitter I know about is one that I developed in 1989, 1990 at Edwards Air Force Base. I developed a pulse generator that had a pulse duration of 1/4 of 1 nanosecond, 250 picoseconds. And I was doing that with a signal at roughly 10 gigahertz, where the signal coming out of the transmitter was 100 picoseconds per cycle. So in other words, each pulse I was transmitting was roughly 3 RF cycles long. You and I can dream about transmitting a pulse that is only one single cycle. In general, you cannot do that. Let me drop it, I'll tell you why. Every realistic antenna you and I are likely to use has a finite Q, a finite bandwidth, a finite number of megacycles over which the antenna gives you a reasonable standing wave ratio response. If I wanted to transmit a pulse that has a rise time of 1/10 of a nanosecond, that means that antenna would have to have a flat frequency response that is 10 gigahertz wide. Very few antennas can do that. The antenna is a kind of a flywheel. You cannot instantaneously bring the flywheel up to full speed and bring it back down to zero speed instantaneously. It's got Q. That's what Q is, stored energy. It is a flywheel. If I started putting pulses into my 80-meter dipole, my 80-meter dipole has a reasonable standing wave ratio from roughly 3.5 to 4 megacycles. It's half a megacycle wide. That's the frequency bandwidth of my 80-meter dipole. If I try to put a brief pulse into that dipole, half a megacycle is 2 microseconds. For me to get a rise time of pulse into that dipole that's any more brief than 2 microseconds would be very difficult. The dipole wouldn't let you do it. It can't force the flywheel to come up to full speed that fast. So no matter what antenna you use, no matter what manner of pulsing the signal you use, in the real world there's usually a limitation as to what is your fastest rise time, fastest fall time, and least amount of pulse duration. There's certain limits below which, on paper, you can go there. In the real world, Mother Nature won't let you get there unless you do some very heroic things. Over to you, Wes. KQRL.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, I understand. But over the long distance, would we be able to picture energy from the impulse or series of the impulse or the burst as the concentration of energy that is flowing on in given direction?
Yeah, there are a number of articles where they've done that. With very fast optical lasers, they have made pulses so brief. In fact, I've done that. Wait a minute now. The pulses that I was generating that were a quarter of a nanosecond long, when that pulse was transmitted in free space, the pulse was a kind of planar wave moving out from the antenna. If I looked at one single pulse, the leading edge of that pulse in free space versus the trailing edge of that pulse in free space, call it the thickness of that flat plane of material moving in free space. A quarter of a nanosecond, speed of light is a nanosecond per foot, there was a quarter of a feet, 3 inches of space existed between the forward edge and the back edge of that pulse that transmitted in space. Because I was making quarter nanosecond pulses, this is an extremely high speed, high resolution radar that I was generating inside of the world's largest anechoic chamber. When I aimed those signals around that chamber, I could resolve all the reflecting targets in that chamber to the nearest quarter of a foot, to the nearest 3 inches. As I aimed that antenna around the chamber and looked at the echoes, I could find the nail that somebody had dropped into the anechoic material. I could find the type N to SMA adapter that somebody had, all the reflecting chunks of metal that were scattered around this 1.5 acre room. I could find every one of them with my very high resolution radar, because that was the distance between the leading edge and the trailing edge of each pulse that I was transmitting. Make some sense? Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
So I understand that the answer is yes. You have an intra-three-dimensional space, you have a concentration of energy that is flowing in one given direction, we have an antenna that is directional. Basically for me, you just conform existence of longitudinal waves.
That wave that I transmitted was a pure TEM wave. Pure TEM wave in that if I looked at the middle of that pulse, if I stopped time and I looked at the middle of the pulse, and I was transmitting a horizontally polarized signal, there was a E field in the horizontal direction. There was no E field in the vertical direction. There was an H field in the vertical direction. There was no H field in the horizontal direction. It was a pure transverse electromagnetic wave. The leading edge and the trailing edge of it was very close together, and there weren't very many cycles of that wave, but that was a pure TEM bundle of energy moving through space. It absolutely had no longitudinal component to it. If I looked in the Z-axis, there was no voltage in the Z-axis. There was no H-field in the Z-axis. All of it was transverse. That was a TEM wave. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
but you confirm the concentration of energy that is moving at one given direction. When the concentration of the energy is moving in one given direction, it is giving through the straight line, like a slinking. You just search to John that the pattern is very much similar to the slinking and is moving forward. So we have a linear component into it, as the speed of light is constant. Enter G.
If I was transmitting a completely continuous, key-down, circular, polarized signal toward John right now, I could call it a slinky in space. The slinky stretches from my house to his house, and that whole slinky is moving toward him at the speed of light. That's a continuous, key-down, circular, polarized wave that I'm sending to John right now in my mind. If I start doing very brief pulses of that signal, it's the exact same slinky going toward John, but now portions of the slinky have been chopped out. So there's now sections of slinky moving toward him. Each section of slinky is a pulse, and there are dead spaces in between where there's no slinky because I had the key up during that time during this pulse train that I'm sending to him. So the fact that I took a continuous signal and started transmitting pulses doesn't change the fact that it's still a circular polarized transverse electromagnetic wave that I'm sending to John. I can interrupt it. That doesn't make it a longitudinal wave. A longitudinal wave must have an E-field component in the Z-axis. I never made any Z-axis E-field component. I just chopped out sections of the slinky. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Do you or don't you have a time delay between the chopped portions of the signals?
A continuous wave was transmitting to him when I ran key down. I start pulsing it. Now there's some interruptions in time. You and I are transmitting interruptions in time all the time when we send Morse code. Are you telling me that every Morse code signal is a longitudinal wave? Over to you, Wes.
So what I'm trying to say is that we have a chunk of energy that is moving in space in the straight line. If the antenna has a omnidirectional pattern, then the straight line goes equally to every direction. If the antenna is a very much directional antenna, say the screw antenna, at that point, or any kind of, let's say dipole, the typical dipole, to the directions, right? Then we have a chunk of energy, impulses, going forward and back. I mean, one direction and to the other. Let me drop. Now, if you look at this pattern, it is moving in the straight line, and it does have a special component of the time delay. The first chunk goes to the receiver 10,000 miles from here, or 10 million miles from here. Then the next one. You said that from the satellite or from the spacecraft that is trying to research other planets, it goes 7 minutes, 10 minutes, few hours. It is chunk of energy that is traveling in space. I want you to confirm this and to agree.
The sun is sending continuous energy toward the Earth right now. When there is a coronal mass ejection, expulsion, whichever it's called, when you have a CME, the amount of energy coming out of the sun during that instant increases. The sun modulates. The fact that the sun has modulated the signal doesn't really change the characteristics of the signal. It just changes its amplitude. The amplitude modulation when you send a analog television signal, it's a carrier that's going up and down with the so-called baseband modulation, the video and audio. So modulating a signal or making the signal into pulses. Pulses are just a more extreme form of modulation. If I modulate it in an analog manner, you and I have a picture on the television screen in the old-fashioned analog television. If I transmit pulses of signal, then I could trace a checkerboard pattern on your television screen. That's just a different kind of modulation. The signal itself is a continuous TEM wave that I did or didn't modulate it in a particular manner. I didn't change it from TEM to something else just because I modulated it. N2XJN, K2RIW.
I don't understand, Dick, why you keep avoiding the answer. You have a simple question to answer, and I'm asking you that simple question. You have a mission spacecraft that is in Mars and is sending signal to the Earth. There is a certain amount of minutes that is required for the signal to come here. And you sent 10,000 pulses. Now, the first pulse came in here, you wait for another one, and for another one, and for another one. That means, do we have or don't we have a chunk of energy in three-dimensional space traveling at given direction through the line, linear motion, and to exit? Yes or no?
I can put pulses of signal through space. I can put pulses of signal through a transmission line. If I put a very brief pulse down a transmission line, I can easily set it up if the pulse is brief enough that the transmitter has turned off before the leading edge of the pulse that I sent a microsecond ago, even before the pulse gets to the receiver at the other end of the cable. I can have a chunk of energy traveling down the middle of a transmission line, just like when the sun gives me a CME,